Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, and today we'll be talking with an author, Kaushik Maradian, who is the author of The Resistance Network, The Armenian Genocide and Humanitarianism in Ottoman Syria, 1915 to 1918, published by Michigan State University Press in 2020. Welcome, Kaushik. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to get started just with an introduction of Kaushik. He has a new position as of January 2021. He was just appointed Armenian and Georgian Area Specialist in the African and Middle Eastern Division, Near East Section at the Library of Congress. He is a lecturer in Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies at Columbia University. And he has published articles on concentration camps, unarmed resistance, the aftermath of mass violence, midwifery in the Middle East, and approaches to teaching history. He is the co-editor of a forthcoming book on late Ottoman history and the editor of the peer-reviewed journal, The Armenian Review. Dr. Maradian has taught courses on imperialism, mass violence, urban space and conflict in the Middle East, the aftermaths of war and mass violence, and human rights. And he's taught these courses at Worcester State University and Clark University in Massachusetts, Rutgers University, Stockton University in New Jersey, and Cal State University Fresno in California. So we're coming to you coast to coast today from Southern California. I'm in San Diego and Kaushik is in New York. And it's a real pleasure to have you. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, so let's get started with this book. First, I love to ask all of the people on my show here what motivated you. So, do you have a reason for writing the book? What prompted you?
So, this is part of my dissertation. It is an expanded version of my PhD dissertation, which I wrote at Clark University, and. The specific topic that focuses on Syria and what is referred to as the second phase of the Armenian Genocide is one that was both inspired by the general environment in the Middle East at that point as I was writing, as I was conducting research in my PhD program. This was a period when the civil war in Syria in sometimes the very same area, cities like Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor were on television every day, were in the news. This was a period when, much of the turbulence in Syria was at its in its earlier stage, and at the same time. In many ways, as I was working on mass violence and genocide, I realized the significance. I was working on the Armenian genocide and realized how what is missing in the scholarship is first the period and the region that I'm looking at. That, and although it is very much an important part of the history of the Armenian genocide, the region I look at is where The largest massacres took place where the greatest number of survivors, in fact, have connections to. Still, it was the least studied in a historiography that is second in the study of the Armenian genocide, which is the second best studied case of genocide after the Holocaust. So this is one central issue. On the one hand, what was going on the ground in the here and now, and on the other, thinking about tackling this subject and this region that is so central for the history of the Armenian genocide, but for a variety of reasons, which we probably will be talking about, did not factor into the scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I'm really interested in how you conceptualize the term resistance and then how you use social network theory in order to broaden it into humanitarianism and then focus on agency. Could you describe how you arrived at your method and how you developed it in the course of the book?
The central concern for me was to not tell the history of genocide by putting those who are referred to as the victims in a position of passivity. So oftentimes, and this is in general a problem in genocide studies, but in the particular case of the Armenian genocide, it's also even more of a challenge. The Armenian genocide is framed in a way that where the Armenians are being massacred by Ottoman Turkish authorities and their policies on the one hand, and are being saved by Western humanitarianism on the other. So the Armenians are being subjected to massacre and humanitarian efforts, and their agency plays little role in what is going on. And this is, of course, due to a number of reasons, that have to do with access to archives, limitations that have to do with language, etc. So this was my starting point. So I wanted to emphasize the role, the voice of the victim group. Now, the resistance portion is also closely connected to this. As you know, much of the discussion about resistance during genocide, for decades, there's this debate about, do victims go to their deaths, like sheep? What is resistance? What constitutes resistance? What does not? And although this debate has been around for a very long time in the case of in Holocaust scholarship, and there's much more clarity there today on that front. In the case of the Armenian genocide and other cases, when we talk about resistance, it is typically defined narrowly as armed resistance. And those are the cases that are the focus of the scholarship whenever, if at all, that aspect is explored. So that's one issue. And so my attempt was to broaden the aperture and think about resistance as actions committed against the will of the authorities in order to thwart essentially their efforts, and against the law with the purpose, intention of saving Armenian lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm particularly interested in your sources, and I want to come back to that because you do, I think, a magnificent job combining a lot of different sources and things that people generally don't look at. But first, I'd like to ask if you could introduce for our listeners the structure of your book. I know that you have three parts. So how did you decide to arrange your chapters, and what decisions did you make content-wise? What are they?
So the first decision I had to make was how to conceptualize what is happening in Ottoman Syria beginning in May 1915 until almost the end of the war, of the First World War. The way I do it is somehow I overlap the temporal and spatial. So I look at the first months of the early arrival of Armenian deportees from across the Ottoman Empire. The Armenian genocide begins in April 1915 with deportations of and massacres of Armenians across the Ottoman Empire. The first convoys of survivors start arriving in Ottoman Syria around in the first weeks of May 1915. So I start with Aleppo because Aleppo mm-hmm. is a hub. This is where the largest number of survivors are arriving beginning in May, and the numbers become much higher by the summer of 1915. And then there are a series of decisions that the Ottoman central authorities are making, which is shutting down the city of Aleppo and pushing the Armenians out of the city into a network of concentration camps mm-hmm. along the lower bend of the Euphrates River, all the way to Raqqa and Deir Zor. Again, these are names that are quite familiar to many of us in light of the civil war in Syria. Now, so what the first half of the book focuses on the urban dimension. It is very much about genocide and resistance in the urban environment of Aleppo. Aleppo has always been seen in the scholarship as a hub of the deportation. And as such, I conceive it also as a central location of resistance to deportation, unarmed resistance to deportation. And then in the second part, the focus moves to more desert areas and along the Euphrates, concentration mm-hmm. camps, where most of the Armenian deportees are interned. And in the third part, I look at the destruction of close to 200,000 Armenians, their massacre, mostly women and children, in Deir Zor, after many of these concentration camps are emptied and the surviving population is pushed towards the region of Deir Zor. This happens in the summer of 1916. So the framework is one where, on the mm-hmm. one hand, so I, in terms of temporally, I'm looking at, beginning from May 1915 into the fall of 1915 in Aleppo, and then into the desert.
Okay. Yeah. I can definitely see that. So, I mean, from Aleppo, how many Armenians were there in Aleppo? Is it about 10,000 or so? Is that right? And then my question would be, from your sources, how did you discover or rediscover their agency, how they began to mobilize and assist in humanitarian work? Could you give us an idea of what was going on based on the sources that you looked at?
Yes. So initially, there was a community of around 10,000 Armenians in the city of Aleppo. This community was by and large not deported, particularly in these early months. So they did have the ability, as deportees from across the Ottoman Empire are arriving in the region, sometimes in horrendous conditions, oftentimes having lost the male population of their town. This local community mobilizes a large effort, humanitarian effort, almost as soon as the first deportees arrive in the region to help them. This mobilization is critical, and it will eventually morph into a resistance. And I'll say a little bit about that mm-hmm. A bit later. But so what happens
sure,
at this point,
please.
the sources I use are largely, the new sources I use are largely Armenian language sources. They are, for example, the minutes of one of the main committees providing relief for these Armenians who are arriving. They met on a daily basis, and we have the records, their minutes. The ledgers of this committee, this council, that maintained detailed records of every single purchase, every single egg, every single piece mm-hmm. of wood, every little bribe that was paid to gendarmes. Everything is listed for the entire duration of the war. as well as some of the lists of deportees they provided. I add to this hundreds of memoirs and accounts by survivors. And I introduce all of this into the scholarship, where there is already tremendous work that has been done on the Ottoman archives, on German archives, and I try to triangulate as I tell this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see a lot of spatial thinking and geography, and I wonder if you could expand on that, because you have not just the cities, as you say, but there's a dynamic here between the urban and rural environment. So how did you do that, both conceptually and with your sources? How did you begin to, let's say, map the stories differently and give us a history from below?
Yes, it was very clear that both the process, the way in which the genocide was essentially unfurled, was occurring on the ground in the province of Aleppo and the city at its core, was not just one that where you had orders coming from the center, from Istanbul, from the central authorities, and the local authorities were just implementing it. Genocide does not progress, you know, with the same degree across an entire empire. There are local variations, of course. And what is happening in the case of Aleppo made it very clear to me that the violence is not just happening in the region, but is also oftentimes of the region. And even more so, the organized effort to save Armenians, this humanitarian resistance, was also one that was very much a product of the urban environment. And I demonstrate that by looking into the hotel, a very well-known hotel, Hotel Baron, one of the best-known hotels in the region at that point, a hospital in the area, the general environment of Aleppo at that point of the city, and the way in which it lent itself to, on the one hand, implementing the destruction of the Armenian population, and on the other, devising ways of saving Armenians. So in the book, especially in the first half of the book, I start with what I refer to as humanitarian efforts. You know, these committees that are formed on the ground by local Aleppo Armenians to help the arriving survivors. And then what happens is that the central authorities start cracking down on these efforts. And many of these committees go underground and continue their work helping survivors in a clandestine way. And in that context, you have many survivors who are arriving in the region who are also joining this effort and participating in the struggle to save as many people as possible.
Yeah, and I definitely want to move to the story of the camps. I mean, both concentration camps and transit camps and the categorization and classification therein. But I had one more question for you. Could you describe how you reread the late 1915 liquidation of the camps? I find this a very interesting section in chapter 3 of your book, where you're talking about the distinct phases and looking at wartime internment. So what are your sources, let's say, show that might be new to that story of the liquidation of the camps in 1915?
So I place the history of concentration camps during the Armenian genocide, and my book is the most recent and in fact the most expanded work on this very little studied aspect of civilian internment. I place it within a broader context of the development of concentration camps in the late 19th and the early 20th centuries, beginning with the Spanish in Cuba and, the United States in the Philippines,
yes,
the British
yes.
in South Africa. So these are the colonial cases where the concentration camp was used as a counterinsurgency method, weapon, alongside policies of scorched earth tactics in order to isolate and neutralize insurgents and separate their support base, the civilian population. What happens in the early 20th century is in German Southwest Africa, the Germans, take this already deadly for civilians, approach and implemented during the Herero genocide, in fact, on the very survivors the initial round. So this becomes a more deadly strain. And my argument in the book is that this deadly strain that emerges of concentration camps, a genocidal strain that emerges in German Southwest Africa, then is also implemented in the case of the Armenian genocide. The Ottoman authorities establish a network of camps across the around Aleppo and then along the Euphrates all the way into Deir ez-Zor, all in modern-day Syria. And they push the population there so that, in order to isolate them, in order for, epidemics play a role here, in order to isolate them and to make sure that they die alone. And ultimately, these camps also become places where this resistance network continues to work and continues to its effort to help people. Ultimately, these camps are liquidated in 1916, beginning in the spring of 1916, the camps are shut down, and whoever survives is pushed further south and southeast along the Euphrates, and then to be massacred mm-hmm. in the region of Deir ez-Zor. So this is how I conceptualize it. I first place it in the context of the evolution of camps. And then I zoom in and demonstrate how this is playing a critical component role here.
Right. I think Kaçık, it's such an interesting idea because you actually read it forward from the 19th century, if I may say so, and the globalization of the internment phenomenon. And, the work of Raymond Kevorkian, I think, is so important here in his history. But the way that you develop it beyond a kind of like encyclopedic catalog in much, much greater depth, making comparisons that take us out of the Third Reich and the Nazi period. I wonder if I could ask you now, sort of like moving into the second big part of the book, you have a chapter called Gateways to the Desert. So what were these camps, Sibyl, Karklik, and Bob? And again, how are you reading the story of the resistance network with your sources?
So what happens in the... So as deportees are arriving in Aleppo, initially in a few hundreds, and then in the thousands and tens of thousands by the summer of 1915, the local authorities are taking a number of measures on the ground to figure out what to do with them. At this point, the central authorities are not really sending much instructions. The focus of the Young Turk leadership is the deportation and the annihilation of the Armenian population in the Ottoman heartland. So they're paying little attention to the survivors who are mm-hmm. trickling into Syria. So at this point, the local Ottoman authorities, some of them, for example, the governor of Aleppo, who was friendly to Armenians, they are trying to help within their means in order to ameliorate the situation of these people. So this during this period, there are many camps that are created around the city of Aleppo, where thousands of arriving deportees are placed. The idea is to keep these camps temporary. The idea, the impression, both among the local authorities and the Armenian population, is that these people are going to be settled somewhere. no one at this point, on the ground,
right,
particularly the Armenians, have any realization that the only place they're going to be allowed to settle in large numbers is going to be under the sands of the desert. It is everything seems temporary, and the resistance network initially starts its efforts. Let me open a parenthesis here and say a few words about humanitarian relief and the scholarship in general. So humanitarianism during the Armenian Genocide is very well studied, and it focuses on the assistance by the United States, millions of dollars, the equivalent of a couple billion dollars in today's money, was raised in the United States during and in the aftermath of the Armenian Genocide for relief purposes. So much of the scholarship focuses on how these funds were collected, how they were sent to the U.S. ambassador in the Ottoman Empire and to consuls, and this huge effort during the genocide and in its aftermath to assist the Armenians. What is missing here is how during the genocide, between 1915 and 1918, these efforts there are these millions of dollars that are pouring into the Ottoman Empire, and they're just being distributed to Armenians. While what's happening is that the central authorities are clearly hindering these efforts, and it is the Armenian clandestine groups who are playing a very dangerous and critical role in making these funds and resources accessible to deportees scattered around the desert as well as in urban areas, right? And so what I do is, what my work does is demonstrates how this network is very much led and moved by people on the ground, locals, primarily Armenians, but also others, Muslims, Jews, and others, and is not just something that is happening to the victims in terms of assistance coming from the West. So there's this integral connection between missionaries, consuls, and the people on the ground that is very important for me. And, and as such, this is an effort
go ahead, I'm sorry.
This is an effort that extends, not just radiates from out of Aleppo, but extends into the entire region.
Yeah, and just as a follow-up to that, it's interesting to me how you reread people like Morgenthau, who's in Istanbul, right, as the U.S. ambassador, or Jesse B. Jackson, and all of the relief organizations. I mean, they're not just Armenian organizations, but Armenian and Syrian relief organizations, which run into a whole mess of problems with Ottoman diplomats, right? So you're looking at this, I would imagine, not just from a diplomatic perspective, but also from the sort of social perspective. Correct me if I'm wrong with that.
Yes, absolutely. And what I do is I try to link the already established scholarship of tremendous humanitarian assistance being sent in the direction of the Ottoman Empire, and then the way in which you have people on the ground, Armenian community leaders, members of committees who are clandestinely getting funds from the, for example, the United States consul in Aleppo, Jesse B. Jackson, and distributing these funds again secretly, sometimes at nighttime, going into these concentration camps, risking their lives. Many of these couriers will die. Many of them will be arrested. Others will get killed. So this is an effort where humanitarianism flows into sometimes the darkest corners of World War I, the heart of mass extermination and destruction, and these individuals whose stories have not been told. The reason, you allow me here, for this particular
go ahead, please.
oversight in the history, in the historiography of the Armenian Genocide, is that much of the scholarship in the past several decades, beginning in the 80s, very much operated in an environment of, first of all, the Turkish state's policy, official policy of denial. So many scholars, essentially were writing in a way that tried to counter that policy of denial, and that played a crucial role. On the other hand, many scholars wanted to introduce to audiences in the West, for example, mainly in the United States, reintroduce the history of the Armenian Genocide and the huge role that Americans, played in terms of collecting assistance and providing assistance. Part of American history, which was something very well known in the 1920s. Everybody was part of this, but it was forgotten, as the scholarship demonstrates. And then, so this is key. And then, so this kind of framework tries to integrate the role of the Armenians on the ground in this effort. And in that sense, it is, it adds to the scholarship from that perspective as well. It is important to note here that three of my advisors, you mentioned Raymond Kevorkian earlier. He was one of my dissertation committee members. Taner Akçam, who is a Turkish scholar, the first Turkish scholar to publish on the Armenian Genocide, and Holocaust scholar Deborah Dvork, have played a huge role in both in my intellectual journey and also in my thinking about many of these issues. So I stand first and foremost, my work stands on the shoulders of hundreds of thousands of these survivors who eventually will also become victims, but they have they leave behind some records, and thousands of survivors who write their memoirs, but also on the work of these great scholars who allowed me to really do this reconstruction, building on their work.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Taner Akçam's work, and maybe we can put Ronald Suni in this as well with his 2015 book. I'm very curious in how you read this historiographically to get out of this, extreme intentionalism, as you call it at one point, right? Do you see prospects then for people to rethink the history of Deir Zor both before and after through Ottoman and Armenian sources, and especially as Ottoman sources become more available, hopefully? Or I don't know. I mean, this is sort of a historiographical question when you're thinking about the continued denialism.
Yes. When I refer to extreme intentionalism, I refer to the early scholarship on the Armenian Genocide that largely mirrored the intentionalist model of the Holocaust. In face of a state-sponsored policy of denial, almost constructing a model that's very similar to the intentionalist model of the Holocaust, it was a way in which it was easy to demonstrate against a policy that says there was no genocide, that this was indeed genocide. But ultimately, genocide studies have evolved over the past couple of decades. And also Armenian genocide studies has evolved. And in many ways, part of the reason I argue that this region, Ottoman Syria, during the Armenian Genocide, was not tackled even by the pioneers of the Armenian Genocide, who will sometimes just say a few paragraphs about it only, because it is complicated, because it is messy, and it does not fit this kind of intentionalist model. What is happening in Ottoman Syria defies that model, because on the one hand, it's not, there is a period beginning in late 1915 and in the first few months of 1916, where the massacres have stopped. Hundreds of thousands of Armenians have been massacred across the Ottoman Empire. Hundreds of thousands of others are languishing in concentration camps or in hiding in urban areas across Ottoman Syria and elsewhere. And it seems like it's over. it seems like this Ottoman state's policy of uprooting and dispossessing the Ottoman Armenian population, and also, of course, it's important to note here, many Greeks and Assyrians, has come to a halt. But then something else happens, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem like, you know, the Ottoman authorities are hell-bent on going after every single Armenian everywhere. Their central purpose and objective is to destroy Armenian community life, is to destroy Armenian organized existence on these lands. And what happens in Syria, therefore, this period where for several months Armenians are even trying to, in certain areas, almost getting back on their feet and organizing and forming communities in towns like Raqqa or Derzor, there's a second onslaught that comes beginning in March, but particularly in the summer of 1916, where a second round of decisions are made. Again, the decisions are made earlier in 1916 and they're implemented through summer of 1916, where these camps are shut down and the population, the surviving population, largely women and children, are massacred. So it's a situation mm-hmm. where really the reconstruction is messy and it doesn't really fit in this way of, you know, the short one-sentence narrative of the Armenian genocide, which is that the Ottoman authorities deported and massacred the Armenians because they did not want to leave one Armenian alive. You know, that kind of simplistic narrative, which has been complicated in recent years, of course, by the scholarship.
Mm-hmm. And in the scholarship, because you, in your book, discuss women and children and orphans a lot, and I'm thinking about, you know, the contribution of Deborah Dwork here, right? So is there a particular story or stories, Kachig, this is a hard question perhaps, but is there a centerpiece to your book? Would there be one story, either a story of women and children, or does it have to be a political elite like Talat, right? What would you say is the centerpiece for your resistance network? I'm actually kind of like asking for names here. If there's one tale or one story that struck you.
Yes. So there are many women in this story, and the way in which their role and in the gendered approach to this is that when I start in Aleppo, where there is an organized community and organized around churches largely, so the Armenian Apostolic Church, Armenian Catholic Church, and Armenian Protestant Church are organizing the initial relief efforts, this is a male dominated effort, right? All the committee members are men, right? Women are only playing an auxiliary role within this, you know, organized relief structure. But as I demonstrate in the book, there's at the same time many women who are playing a critical role and are only loosely connected to this network. That's one. And I also show how the farther away we go from the heartland, from the center, from Aleppo, where this effort is radiating from, you have more and more women, as this network becomes loosely connected, playing a critical role in the effort to save Armenians. So I document the stories of a number of women in this regard, but perhaps telling one story could illustrate some of the complexities of this narrative. One such person is a woman by the name of Elmas Santurian. And if you allow me to take just 1 minute to tell her story in a nutshell.
Yes, that's what I'm asking for. Please. Yes. I think our listeners would really like that. Go ahead, please.
So in her case, she is a massacre widow. Her husband is killed during an earlier round of massacres in 1909. After which she receives support from an Armenian women's organization and is taken from her town Marash into Constantinople to study nursing and midwifery. And after that, she graduates in 1914 and the war erupts. By the time she's back home, soon after, the deportations of the Armenian population begin and she's forced to Aleppo. She contracts typhus along the way, gets sick, is on her deathbed, and an Armenian doctor who was part of the resistance network saves her life. Now you have a nurse who is trained as a nurse, who is also who also has immunity while typhus is ravaging the entire region, and particularly the camps, the Armenian population. And she becomes an important critical player because she is hired essentially by a local, so the head of one of the military hospitals in Aleppo, Ottoman military hospitals in Aleppo, whose daughter's life she saves as a nurse. She had typhus too. The daughter had typhus. The man hires her to be the head nurse at the military hospital. And this woman single-handedly helped save the lives of dozens of Armenian women by securing passes for them and permits for them and hiring them to work in the hospital, thus anchoring them in the city while the Ottoman authorities are systematically emptying the city of Armenian deportees. So this is one example of such an effort. There's mm-hmm. another woman, Araxa Jabedjian, who is working very closely with a Swiss teacher, Beatrice Rohner, who is very well known in the scholarship on the Armenian genocide for her assistance and role. And this woman, Araxa Jabedjian, is based in Deir Zor and is constantly sending reports to Beatrice Rohner, who in turn is passing these reports to consuls. These reports are ending up in newspapers across the globe, including the United States. So, and ultimately, in the summer of 1916, Araxa Jabedjian is arrested and killed right before the Deir Zor massacres. Again, these are just two examples. The book is full of examples of men, women, and children who are taking part in this resistance effort.
Right. Right. And you talk a lot about these informal networks and the violence within and the supply lines. So, I mean, what would you imagine from your work? And of course, you know, you're the editor of the Armenian Review. What sort of things could you imagine seeing in further empirical research and then in the historiography of genocide and Holocaust studies?
Thank you for the question, Stephen. You know, in recent years, there are some very interesting work that's being done in Turkey itself. There's a young generation of Turkish scholars who are not only just, you know, we are past, you know, the just scholars challenging the denialist narrative. And there's at this point a vast scholarship that is really moving on into some of these less known aspects and trying to shed light and think about mass violence by using the Armenian genocide as a case study. There are many local and regional studies that are being published. Scholars like Ümit Kürt, Uğur Ümit Ünger, scholars who have been done work both in Turkey, in the Ottoman archives and elsewhere, have really have helped shape our thinking about a lot of these local histories and their implications for our thinking about mass violence. So in that sense, that is a very exciting development. On the other hand, between the scholarship, the new scholarship, thinking about the Holocaust and thinking about colonial cases of genocide and genocide in the 20th century, I think we have the theoretical tools that we have become more complex and more nuanced. There's more connections, for example. In my work, I take from a little bit from network theory, but also a lot from urban studies. I borrow a lot from the theoretical frameworks and approaches in Holocaust studies as I think about much of this. So there's this dynamic young generation of scholars in Turkey and beyond that are really bringing fresh perspective into the fore.
And really, I think my last question before we sort of move on to your current projects and things that you might recommend or books you might recommend, you have in chapter 8 a conclusion, and I think the conclusion is very interestingly titled "Surviving Talat: the network's legacy. So there's a two-part question that I have to ask. So, you know, first for our listeners, who was Talat and how does the Armenian community survive him? And then what is the network's legacy within the Armenian diaspora? So this is kind of an Armenian-centric question, but I'd like to hear your input on it and how you would reason this in the concluding points to your book.
Thank you. So Talat Pasha was the Minister of Interior and considered to be the main architect of the Armenian genocide. He is known to have told diplomats, consuls, others that he is essentially solving the Armenian question by getting rid of the Armenians. And in that sense, I titled the last chapter Surviving Talat because it is very much about how both during the Armenian genocide and in the rebuilding process in the aftermath of the Armenian genocide, the Armenian, this organized network of Armenians and many others who are part of this pushing back against these genocidal policies are actually also laying the groundwork for the survival and revival that is going to come after Ottoman defeat in World War I and Ottoman withdrawal from Syria. And so in that sense, I see this period that I say a little about in my final chapter as a period where the very people sometimes who survived, who were engaged in this resistance effort, humanitarian resistance effort, and managed to survive, were not arrested, killed, become some of the people who are playing an integral part in the rebuilding of the Armenian community, now cast out of their ancestral homes, now in places like Syria, Lebanon, mm-hmm. France, and North America, and elsewhere. So in many ways, I try to show how, for example, in one example, I talk about this young man who was a courier for the U.S. consulate in Aleppo, passing, transferring funds to a Reverend Eskigian and several others in order to help the deportees. Reverend Eskigian dies of typhus. He contracts from the very deportees he was helping. He was an important member of the network, but this young man, John Minasian, survives the war, and I conclude the book with a scene where he goes and visits the gravesite of Reverend Eskigian, who did not survive, and he's accompanied by the Swiss teacher that I mentioned earlier and the wife of the Reverend Eskigian, in a way. Trying to show how this was a collaborative effort between Westerners, locals, children, mm-hmm. others, and then sails to the United States. The rest of the story of this young man and his service to rebuilding the Armenian communities continues in the United States. The same applies to several others who stay in Aleppo or end up in Beirut and help rebuild these communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And could you please recommend for our listeners here at New Books Network some other works? And these could be monographs or they could be larger works of synthesis or in historiography. I'm very curious because as a scholar, too, of camps and ghettos and especially concentration camps and transit camps, in my work for U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, I'm curious to see in your conclusion, if you perhaps could drop a few names and give our listeners some other things that they might be able to read.
Thank you. So some of the monumental works on the Armenian genocide are authored by historians such as Taner Akçam, Raymond Kevorkian. We just mentioned Talat Pasha. There's an excellent biography of Talat Pasha by scholar Hans-Lukas Kieser that just came out a couple years ago. From the younger generation of scholars, there are scholars such as Ümit Kürt, whose book on the Armenians of Aintab, essentially a study of the genocide and the economics of the process in the province of Aintab in the Ottoman Empire is forthcoming in a few months. So that, as far as the Armenian genocide is concerned, there are some really interesting works in recent years that urge us to rethink what a concentration, the history of concentration camps. You know, typically when many of us think about concentration camps, yeah, we think about Auschwitz. And just a couple of days ago was the 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. But in many ways, books such as One Long Night, books such as that, or collections of articles, yes, that about World War One, civilian internment during World War One, really allow us to have perspective on the way in which this deadly weapon, the weapon of civilian internment, forced civilian internment, has changed and evolved over decades from the late 19th century into our days.
And could you maybe say a few words about your current projects? I know we talked at the beginning about your new position at the Library of Congress. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and what you are working on currently with your research and projects, or might be interested in the near future.
I'm just starting my responsibility as the area specialist, Armenian and Georgian area specialist at the Library of Congress. There's a huge collection of Armenian and Georgian material, I look forward to working with scholars and others, librarians and others, both in terms of expanding these collections and also making them available, accessible to researchers and the general public. My next research book project, which is, I'm halfway there, focuses on the notebooks of two midwives, Armenian midwives from the Ottoman town of Aintab, who kept ledgers of every single childbirth they officiated. We're talking around 6,000 to 7,000 children.
Wow.
from the city of Aintab.
Wow.
From the city of Aintab. And then in the 1920s, when they're forced out of Turkey, they arrive in Aleppo and they continue their work in the city of Aleppo. So this is their story, and through them it is a story of the essentially the birth of the modern Middle East. Their ledgers provide details about you know Arabs, Muslims, Turks, Jews, Mormons, Armenians, Christians, all these different groups, religious, ethnic, through this you know, essentially, and details about these births, these families, different customs and traditions, and they are, it is the kind of archival work that I love best. These are the archives that are on the margins.
These are
documents that are in the drawers of families that sometimes are forgotten or are gathering dust. And in this case, these two ledgers have traversed the world, in fact, and arrived in New Jersey, where a family member share them with me. So I look forward to sharing the story of these two midwives with the world.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic, Kacik. Those are things I love reading, and I hope get translated too. Is it all in Armenian, or some of those memoirs in other languages?
So the documents, their notebooks are in Armeno-Turkish. They are in Armenian letters, but Turkish language, and we already have prepared and completed a transcript of all of this, because there's a lot of names. It's systematically gone through that, there, hopefully also the full two ledgers of, so each midwife had her own ledger. One starts working as a midwife in 1888, and until she dies, the other starts in 1905, and then again, her entire life, decades over decades, is dedicated to this. I'm very much hoping to share these ledgers and the transcripts as well, and make them available online.
Well, thank you. So I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and we've been speaking with Dr. Kacik Moradian here. He is the author of a new book called The Resistance Network, The Armenian Genocide and Humanitarianism in Ottoman Syria, 1915 to 1918. This book is published in 2020 by Michigan State University Press. Thank you, Kacik, for the conversation today and for joining us here on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.